91. Dennis also found an old pair of snowshoes in the basement. The straps were far too large, but he had plenty of time to shorten them. The lacings had begun to rot, and there was nothing Dennis could do about that, but he thought they would serve the purpose. He wouldn't need them for long. He slept in the cellar, fearing surprise, but during the daylight hours of those 4 long days, Dennis spent most of his time in the parlor of the deserted farmstead, watching the traffic pass to and fro. What little there was began around 3 o'clock and had mostly ceased by 5, when early winter shadows began to cover the land. The parlor was a sad, empty place. Once it had been a cheery spot in which the family had gathered to discuss the day just done. Now it belonged only to the mice. And to Dennis, of course. Pena, after hearing Dennis declare that he could read and write pretty well for a fellow in service, and seeing him draw his great letters — this had been over breakfast on Tuesday, the last real meal Dennis had had since his own lunch on Monday, a meal he looked back on with understandable nostalgia — had provided him with several sheets of paper and a lead pencil. And during most of the hours he spent in the deserted house, Dennis labored earnestly over a note. He wrote, scratched out, rewrote, frowned horribly as he reread, scratched his head, resharpened his pencil with his knife, and wrote again. He was ashamed of his spelling and terrified he would forget some crucial thing Pena had told him to put in. There were several times when his poor frazzled brain could make no more progress, when he wished Pena had stayed up an hour longer on the night Dennis had come and written his own damned note, or called it aloud to Arlen. Most times, however, he was glad of the job. He had worked hard his whole life, and idleness made him nervous and uneasy. He would rather have worked his sturdy young man's body than his not-so-sturdy young man's brains, but work was work, and he was glad to have it. By Saturday noon, he had a letter he was pretty well satisfied with, which was good, since he had worked his way down to the final 2 sheets of notepaper. He looked at it with some admiration. It covered both sides of the paper and was by far the longest thing he had ever written. He folded it to the size of a medicine tablet and then peeked out the sitting room window, waiting impatiently for it to be dark enough to leave. Peter saw the gathering clouds from his own poor sitting room atop the needle, Dennis from the sitting room of this deserted house. But both had been taught by their fathers, one a king and the other a butler to that king, to read the sky, and Dennis also thought there would be snow tomorrow. By 4, the long blue shadow of the house had begun to creep out from the foundations, and Dennis no longer felt so eager to go. It was danger ahead, deadly danger. He was to go where Flag was perhaps even now brooding long over his infernal magics, perhaps even now checking upon a certain sick butler. But how he felt did not really matter, and he knew it. The time had come to do his duty, and as every butler in his family line had done for centuries and centuries, Dennis would do his best. He left the house in the bleak sunset hour, donned the snowshoes, and struck off across the field on a direct line toward the castle keep. The idea of wolves occurred to his uneasy mind, and he could only hope there would be none, and if there were, that they would leave him alone. He hadn't the slightest idea that Peter had decided to make his dangerous escape attempt the following night, but like Pena, and Peter himself, he felt a need to hurry. It seemed to him that there were mackerel-scale clouds laid across his heart as well as the sky. As he trudged through the snow-desolate fields, Dennis's thoughts turned to how he might enter the castle without being seen and challenged. He thought he knew how it could be done, if that was Flag did not smell him. He had no more than thought the magician's name when a wolf howled somewhere out in the still white wastes. In a dark room below the castle, Flag's own sitting room, the magician sat bolt upright suddenly in his chair, where he had fallen asleep with a book of arcane lore open on his stomach.
"Who speaks the name of Flag?"
the magician whispered, and the two-headed parrot shrieked. Standing in the center of a long and desolate field of white, Dennis heard that voice, as dry and scabrous as a spider's scuttle in his own head. He paused, his breath indrawn and held. When he finally let it go, it plumed frosty from his mouth. He was cold all over, but hot drops of sweat stood out on his forehead. From his feet he heard dry snapping noises, pook, 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 as several of the snowshoes' rotted cross-lacings let go. The wolf howled in the silence. It was a hungry, heartless sound.
"No one,"
Flagg muttered in the sitting room of his dark apartments. He was rarely sick, could remember being sick only 3 or 4 times in all of his long life, but he had caught a bad cold in the north, sleeping on the frozen ground, and although he was improving, he was still not well.
No one. A dream, that's all.
He took the book from his lap, closed it, and set it on a side table. The surface of this table had been handsomely dressed in human skin, and settled back in his chair. Soon he slept again. In the snowy fields west of the castle, Dennis slowly relaxed. A single drop of stinging sweat ran into his eye, and he wiped it away absently. He had thought of Flagg, and somehow Flagg had heard him. But now the dark shadow of the magician's thought had passed over him, as the shadow of a hawk may pass over a crouching rabbit. Dennis let out a long, shaky sigh. His legs felt weak. He would try, oh, with all his heart he would try, to think of the magician no more. But as the night came on and the moon with its ghostly fairy ring rose in the sky, that was a thing easier resolved upon than done. 92. At 8 of the clock, Dennis left the fields and entered the king's preserves. He knew them well enough. He had been a squireen for Brandon when his da bottled the old king in the fields of the hunt, and Roland had come here often, even in his old age. Thomas came less often, but on the few occasions when the boy king did come, Dennis had, of course, been required to come with him. Soon he struck on a trail he knew, and just before midnight he reached the verge of this toy forest. He stood behind a tree, looking out at the castle wall. It was half a mile away, over open, snow-covered ground. The moon was still shining, and Dennis was all too aware of the sentries who walked the castle parapet. He would have to wait until Prince Ailan had driven his silvery chariot over the edge of the world before crossing that open space. Even then he would be horribly exposed. He had known from the first that this would be the riskiest part of the whole adventure. Parting from Pena and Arlan, with the good sun shining down, the risk had seemed acceptable. Now it seemed utterly mad. "Go back," a cowardly voice inside him begged. But Dennis knew he couldn't. His father had laid a charge on him, and if the gods meant him to die trying to fulfill it, then he would die. Faint and yet clear, like a voice heard in a dream, came the call of the crier, drifting out to him from the castle's central tower. 12 o'clock and all's well. Nothing's well, Dennis thought miserably. Not one single thing. He drew his thin coat more tightly around him and began the long job of waiting down the moon. Eventually it left the sky, and Dennis knew he had to move. Time had grown short. He stood, said a brief prayer to his gods, and began to walk across the open space as rapidly as he could, expecting a hail of "Who goes there?" from the castle walls at every moment. The hail did not come. The clouds had thickened across the night sky. All below the castle wall was one dark shadow. In less than 10 minutes, Dennis had reached the edge of the moat. He sat on its low bank, the snow crunching under his bottom, and took the snowshoes off. He slid down onto the moat itself, which was frozen and covered with more snow. Dennis's thundering heart slowed down. He was in the shadow of the bulking castle wall now, and would not be seen unless a sentry happened to look straight down, and most probably not even then. Dennis was careful not to go all the way across the moat, not yet, because the ice close to the castle wall would be rotted and thin. He knew why this was so. The reason for the thin ice and the unpleasant smell here and the mossy wetness on the huge stones of the outer wall was his hope of entering the castle secretly. He moved carefully to the left, ears listening for the noise of running water. At last he heard it and looked up. There, at eye height, was a round black hole in the solid castle wall. Fluid ran from it in listless streams. It was a sewer outflow pipe.
"Now for it," Dennis muttered.
He drew back 5 paces, ran, and leaped. As he did, he felt the ice, rotted by the constant outflow of warm waste from the pipe, give under his feet. Then he was clinging to the mossy lip of the pipe. It was slick, and he had to clutch hard to keep from falling. He pulled himself up, digging for purchase with his feet, and finally yanked himself inside. He paused for a moment, trying to get his breath back, then began to crawl along the pipe, which slanted steadily upward. He and several of his playmates had found these pipes when they were children and had been quickly warned off by their parents, partly because they might become lost, mostly because of the sewer rats. Still, Dennis thought he knew where he would come out. An hour later, in a deserted corridor of the castle's east wing, a sewer grating moved, was still, then moved again. It was shoved partway aside, and a few moments later a very dirty and very smelly butler named Dennis pulled himself out of a hole in the floor and lay panting on the cold cobbles. He could have used a longer rest, but someone might come along, even at this unearthly hour. So he replaced the grating and looked around. He did not recognize the hallway at once, but this in no way upset him. He started down it toward the T-intersection at the far end. At least, he reflected, there had been no rats in the warren of sewer pipes below the castle. That had been a great relief. He had been prepared for them, not just because of the gruesome tales his Da had told him, but because there had been rats on a few occasions when he and his mates had ventured with fearful screeches of laughter down into the pipes as children. The rats had been part of the scary dare-you adventure of it. Probably there were just a few mice, and your memories exaggerated them into rats, Dennis thought now. This was not the truth, but Dennis would never know it. His memory of the rats in the sewers was a true one. The pipes had been infested with great, disease-bearing rodents since time out of mind. It had only been for the last 5 years that they had ceased to teem in the sewers. They had been wiped out by flag. The magician had rid himself of both a piece of stone and his own dagger by means of a sewer grating similar to the one from which Dennis had emerged on this early Sunday morning. He had rid himself of them, of course, because there were a few flecks of the deadly green dragon sand on each. The fumes from those few grains had killed the rats, burning many of them alive even as they paddled through the scummy water in the pipes, suffocating all the others before they could flee. 5 years later, the rats had still not come back, although most of the poisonous fumes had dissipated. Most, but not all. If Dennis had entered one of the sewer pipes a bit closer to Flagg's apartments, he might well have died himself. Perhaps it was luck that saved him, or fate, or those gods he prayed to. I'll not take a stand on the matter. I tell tales, not tea leaves, and on the subject of Dennis's survival, I leave you to your own conclusions. 93. He reached the junction, peered around the corner, and saw a sleepy young guard of the watch passing farther up the way. Dennis pulled back. His heart was thumping hard again, but he was satisfied. He knew where he was. When he looked back, the guard was gone. Dennis moved quickly, up this corridor, down that flight of stairs, across t'other gallery. He moved with speedy sure-footedness, for he had spent his whole life in the castle. He knew it well enough, certainly, to find his way from the east wing, where he had come out of the sewers, to the lower west wing, where the napkins were stored. But because he dared not be seen, not by anyone, Dennis went by the most obscure corridors he knew, and at the sound of every footfall, either real or imagined, and I do think quite a few of them were imagined, he withdrew into the nearest cranny or niche. In the end, it took him over an hour. He thought he had never been so hungry in his life.
Never mind your cussed belly now, Dennis. Take care of your master first, your belly later.
He was standing far back in a shadowy doorway. Faintly, he heard the crier call 4 o'clock. He was about to move forward when slow, echoing footfalls came down the hallway, a clank of steel and scabbard, a creak of leather leggings. Dennis pushed himself farther back into the shadows, sweating. A guard of the watch paused just in front of the thinly shadowed doorway where Dennis hid. The fellow stood for a moment rooting in his nose with his little finger, and then leaned over to blow a stream of snot between his knuckles. Dennis could have reached out and touched him, had felt certain that any moment the guard would turn, his eyes would widen, he would draw his short sword, and that would be the end of Dennis, son of Brandon.
Please, Dennis's frozen mind whispered, please, oh please.
He could smell the guard, could smell the old wine and burned meat on his breath and the sour sweat coming out of his skin. The guard started to move on. Dennis began to relax. Then the guard stopped and began rooting in his nose again. Dennis could have screamed.
I have a girl name of Marchy Marchy Melda. the guard began to sing in a low-pitched, droning voice, rooting in his nose all the while. He produced a large green something, examined it thoughtfully, and flicked it onto the wall.
Splat. She's got a sister named Esmeralda. I would sail the seven seas just to kiss her dimply knees. Tutty sing, tay sing, tea, pass me a bucket of wine.
Something exceedingly horrible was now happening to Dennis. His nose had begun to itch and tickle in a way which was unmistakable. Very soon he would sneeze.
Go!
He screamed in his mind.
Oh, why don't you go, you stupid fool?
But the guard seemed to have no intentions of going. He had apparently struck a rich lode up in the left nostril, and he meant to mine it.
I have a girl named of Darche, Darche, Darla. She's got a sister named Red-Headed Carla. I would take 1,000 sips from her pretty, pretty lips. Tutty sing, tay sing tea, and pass me a bucket of wine.
I'll hit you over the head with a bucket of wine, you fool, Dennis thought. Move on!
The itch in his nose grew steadily worse, but he did not dare even touch it for fear the guard would see the movement from the corner of his eye. The guard frowned, bent over, blew his nose between his knuckles again, and finally moved on, still singing his droning song. He was barely out of sight before Dennis threw his arm over his own nose and mouth and sneezed into the crook of his elbow. He waited for the clash of metal as the guard drew his sword and whirled back, but the fellow was half asleep and still half drunk from whatever party he had been at before his tour of duty commenced. Once, Dennis knew, such a slovenly creature would have been quickly discovered and sent to the farthest reaches of the kingdom, but times had changed. There was a click of a latch, the of hinges as a door was drawn open, and then it boomed closed, cutting off the guard's song just as he reached the chorus again. Dennis sagged back in his niche for a moment, eyes closed, cheeks and forehead on fire, his feet twin blocks of ice.
For a few minutes there I didn't think of my belly at all,
he thought, and then he had to slam both hands over his mouth to stifle a giggle. He peeked out of his hiding place, saw no one about, and moved to a doorway down the corridor and on his right. He knew this doorway very well, although the empty rocker and needlework case outside it were new to him. The door led to the room where all of those napkins had been stored since the time of Kyla the Good. It had never been locked before, and was not now. Old napkins were apparently not considered worth locking up. He peered inside, hoping that his answer to Pena's key question still held true. Standing there in the road on that bright morning 5 days ago, Pena had asked him this.
Do you know when they take fresh stores of napkins to the needle, Dennis?
This seemed like a simple question indeed to Dennis, but you may have noticed that all questions seem simple if you know the answers, and most horribly difficult if you don't. That Dennis knew the answer to this one was a testament to his honesty and honor, although those traits were so deeply ingrained in his character that he would have been surprised if someone had told him this. He had taken money, Anders Pena's money, in fact, from Benstad to make sure those napkins were delivered. Only a guilder, true, but money was money and pay was pay. He had felt honor-bound to make sure, from time to time, that the service was continuing. He told Pena about the big storeroom. Pena was flabbergasted to hear of it, and how each Saturday night around 7 o'clock, a maid took 21 napkins, shook them, ironed them, folded them, and set them in a stack on a small wheeled cart. This cart stood just inside the room's doorway. Early on Sunday morning, at 6 o'clock, less than 2 hours from right now, a servant boy would pull the cart to the plaza of the Needle. He would rap at the bolted door at the base of the ugly stone tower, and one of the lesser warders would pull the cart inside and place the napkins on a table, where they would be doled out meal by meal through the week. Pena had been satisfied. Dennis now hurried forward, feeling inside his shirt for the note he had written at the farmhouse. He had a bad moment or two when he couldn't find it, but then his fingers closed over it and he sighed with relief. It had only slipped a little to one side. He lifted the Sunday breakfast napkin. Sunday lunch. For a moment he almost passed over Sunday supper as well, and if he had done that, my tale would have had a very different ending. Better or worse, I cannot say, but surely different. In the end, however, Dennis decided 3 napkins deep was safe enough.
He had found a pin in a crack between two boards in the farmhouse living room and had nipped it into one shoulder strap of the rough linsey camisole he wore as underwear. And if he had been thinking a little better, he would have nipped the note to his underwear with it in the bargain and spared himself that bad moment. But as I may have told you, Dennis's brains were sometimes a little lacking. Now he retrieved the pin and carefully attached the note to an inner fold of the napkin.
"Let it find you, Peter,"
he murmured in the ghostly silence of that storeroom, piled high with napkins made in another age.
"Let it find you, my king."
Dennis knew he must lie low now. The castle would be waking up soon. Stable boys would be stumbling out to the barns. Washerwomen would be moving to the laundries. Cook's apprentices would be stumbling puffy-eyed and sleepy to their fires. Thinking of the kitchens made Dennis's belly rumble anew. By now, even the hateful turnips would have tasted quite nice, but food, he reckoned, would have to wait. He worked his way farther back into the big room. The stacks were so high, the ways so zigzagging and irregular, that it was like working his way into a maze. The napkins gave off a sweet, dry, cottony smell. He finally reached one of the far corners, and here he reckoned he would be safe. He overspilled a stack of the napkins, spread them out, and took another handful for a pillow. It was by far the most luxurious mattress he had ever lain upon, and, hungry as he was, he needed sleep much more than food after his long walk and the frights of the night. He was asleep in no time at all and was troubled by no dreams. We will leave him now, with the first part of his job well and bravely accomplished. We will leave him turned upon his side, right hand curled under his right cheek, sleeping on a bed of royal napkins. And I would like to make a wish for you, listener, that your sleep this night be as sweet and as blameless as his was all that day. 94. On Saturday night, as Dennis was standing in the horror of that wolf's howl and feeling the shade of Flagg's thought pass over him, Ben Stodd and Naomi Reachel were encamped in a snowy hollow 30 miles north of Paynus Farm, or what had been Paynus Farm before Dennis showed up with his story of a king who walked and talked in his sleep. They had made the sort of rough camp people make when they mean to spend only a few hours and then push on. Naomi had seen to her beloved huskies while Ben put up a small tent and built a roaring fire. Shortly, Naomi joined him at the fire and cooked deer meat. They ate in silence, and then Naomi went to check the dogs again. All were sleeping except for Frisky, her favorite. Frisky looked at her with almost human eyes and licked her hand.
"A good pull today, my dear," Naomi said. "Sleep now. Catch a moon rabbit."
Frisky obediently put her head down on her paws. Naomi smiled and went back to the fire. Ben sat before it, his knees pulled up to his chest and his arms around them. His face was somber and thoughtful.
"Snow's coming." "I can read the clouds as well as you, Ben Stodd, and the fairies have made a ring around Prince Island's head."
Ben glanced at the moon and nodded. Then he looked back at the fire.
"I'm worried. I've had dreams of, well, dreams of one it's better not to name."
She lit a cigar. She offered the little package, which was wrapped in muslin to prevent drying, to Ben, who shook his head.
"I've had the same dreams, I think," she said.
She tried to make her voice casual, but was betrayed by a slight tremor. He stared around at her, eyes wide.
"Aye," she said, as if he had asked. "In them, he looks into some bright, glowing thing and speaks Peter's name. I've never been one of your skittish little girls who screeches at the sight of a mouse or a spider in its web, but I waked from that dream wanting to scream aloud."
She looked both ashamed and defiant.
"How many nights have you had it?"
"2.
"I've had it 4 a-running. Mine's just the same as yours. And you needn't look like I'm going to laugh at you or call you little Nell weeping at the well. I also wake up wanting to scream."
"This bright thing, at the end of my dreams, he seems to blow it out. Is it a candle, do you think?"
"No, you know it's not."
She nodded. Ben considered.
"Something far more dangerous than a candle, I think. I'll take that cigar you offered, if I may."
She gave him one. He lit it from the fire. They sat a while in silence, watching the sparks rise toward the dark wind, which trawled gnats of powdery field snow through the sky. Like the light in the dream they'd shared, the sparks blew out. The night seemed very black.
Ben could smell snow in that wind. A great deal of snow, he thought. Naomi seemed to read his thought.
I think such a storm as the old folks tell about may be on the way. What do you think?
The same. With a hesitation utterly unlike her usual forthright manner, Naomi asked,
What does the dream mean, Ben?
He shook his head.
I can't tell. Danger to Peter, that much is clear. If it means anything else, anything I can ken, is that we must hurry.
He looked at her with an urgent directness that made her heart speed up.
Can we reach Paina's farm tomorrow, do you think?
We should be able to. No one but the gods can say that a dog won't break a leg or that a killer bear who can't sleep his winter sleep won't come out of the woods and kill us all, but we should be able to. I exchanged all the dogs I used on the run-up except for Frisky, and Frisky's almost tireless. If the snow comes early, it'll slow us down, but I think it will hold off, and off, and for every hour it does, it'll be that much worse when it finally comes, or so I think. But if it does hold off, and if we take turns jumping off the sledge and running alongside, I think we can make it. But what can we do except sit there unless your friend the butler returns?
I don't know.
Ben sighed and rubbed a hand over his face. What good indeed. Whatever it was the dreams foretold, it would happen at the castle, not at the farm. Paina had sent Dennis to the castle, but how did Dennis mean to get in? Ben didn't know, because Dennis hadn't told Paina. And if Dennis did gain entry undetected, where would he hide? There were 1,000 possible places, except...
Ben.
What?
Jerked out of his thoughts, he turned to her.
What did you think of just now?
Nothing.
Yes, something. Your eyes gleamed.
Did they? I must have been thinking of pies. It's time you and I turned in. We'll want to be off at first light.
But in the tent, Ben Stad lay awake long after Naomi had gone to sleep. There were 1,000 places in the castle to hide, yes, but he could think of 2 rather special ones. He thought he might well find Dennis in one or the other. At last he fell asleep. And dreamed of Flag. 95.
Peter began that Sunday as he always did with his exercises and a prayer. He had awakened feeling fresh and ready. After a quick look at the sky to gauge the progress of the coming storm, he ate his breakfast. And of course, he used his napkin. 96. By Sunday noon, everyone in Delane had come out of his or her house at least once to look worriedly toward the north. Everyone agreed that the storm, when it came, would be one to tell stories about in later years. The clouds rolling in were a dull gray, the color of wolf pelts. Temperatures rose until the icicles hanging beneath the eaves of the alleys began to drip for the first time in weeks, but the old-timers told each other, and anyone else who would listen, that they were not fooled. The temperature would plummet quickly, and hours later, perhaps 2, perhaps 4, the snow would begin, and they said it might fall for days. By 3 o'clock that afternoon, those farmers of the inner baronies, fortunate enough to still have livestock to watch out for, had gotten their animals into the barns. The cows went mooing their displeasure. The snow had melted enough for them to crop last fall's dry grasses for the first time in months. Josef, older, grayer, but still lively enough at 72, saw that all the king's horses were stabled. Presumably there was someone else to take care of all the king's men. Wives took advantage of the mild temperatures to attempt to dry sheets, which otherwise simply would have frozen on the lines, and then took them in as the daylight lowered toward an early, storm-colored dark. They were disappointed. Their washing had not dried. There was too much moisture in the air. Animals were skittish. People were nervous. Wise mead housekeepers would not open their doors. They had observed the falling mercury in their barometric glasses, and long experience had taught them that low air pressure makes men quick to fight. Delane battened down for the coming storm, and everyone waited. 97. Ben and Naomi took turns running beside the sledge. They reached the Paina farm at 2 o'clock that Sunday afternoon. At about the same time, Dennis was stirring awake on his mattress of royal napkins, and Peter was beginning his meager lunch. Naomi looked beautiful indeed. The flush of her exercise had colored her tanned cheeks the pretty dusky red of autumn roses. As the sledge pulled into Pena's yard, the dogs barking wildly, she turned her laughing face to Ben.
A record run by the gods, she cried. We've made it 4 hours earlier than I would have believed when we left, and not one dog has burst its heart. Aye, Frisky, aye, good dog.
Frisky, a huge black and white Anduin husky with grey-green eyes, was at the head of the tether. She was jumping in the air, straining against the traces. Naomi unhooked her and danced with her in the snow. It was a curious waltz, both graceful and barbaric. Dog and mistress seemed to laugh at each other in a powerful shared affection. Some of the other dogs were lying down on their sides now, panting hard, obviously exhausted, but neither Frisky nor Naomi seemed even slightly winded.
Aye, Frisky, aye, my love. Good dog, you've led a famous chase.
But for what? Ben asked glumly.
She released Frisky's paws and turned to him, angry. But the dejection on his face robbed her of her anger. He was looking toward the house.
She followed his gaze and understood. They were here, yes, but where was here? An empty farmhouse, that was all. What in the world had they come so far and so fast for? The house would have been just as empty 1 hour, 2 hours, 4 hours from now. Pena and Arlen were in the north, Dennis somewhere in the depths of the castle, or in a prison cell, or a coffin awaiting burial if he had been caught. She went to Ben and put a hesitant hand on his shoulder.
Don't feel so bad, she said. We've done all we could do.
Have we? He asked. I wonder.
He paused and sighed deeply. He had taken off his knitted cap and his golden hair gleamed mellowly in the dull afternoon light.
I'm sorry, Naomi. I don't mean to snap at you. You and your dogs have done wonders. It's just that I feel we're very far from where we could give any real aid. I feel helpless.
She looked at him, sighed, and nodded.
Well, he said, let's go in. Maybe there'll be some sign of what we're to do next. We'd at least be out of the blow when it comes.
There were no clues inside. It was just a big, drafty, empty farmhouse that had been quit in a hurry. Ben prowled restlessly from room to room and found nothing at all. After an hour, he collapsed unhappily beside Naomi in the sitting room, in the very chair where Anders Pena had sat when he listened to Dennis's incredible story.
If only there was a way to track him, Ben said.
He looked up to see her staring at him, her eyes bright and round and full of excitement.
There might be, she said, if the snow holds off.
What are you talking about?
Frisky, she cried. Don't you see? Frisky can track him. She has the keenest nose of any dog I've ever known.
The scent would be days old, he said, shaking his head. Even the greatest tracking dog that ever lived could not.
Frisky may be the greatest tracking dog that ever lived, Naomi replied, laughing. And tracking in winter's not like tracking in summer, Ben Stad. In summer, trace dies quickly. It rots, Mada says, and there are 100 other traces to cover the one the dog seeks. Not just of other people and other animals, but of grasses and warm winds, even the smells that come on running water. But in the winter, trace lasts. If we had something that belonged to this Dennis, something that carried his scent.
What about the rest of your team? Ben asked.
I should open the shed over there, she pointed at it, and leave my bedroll in it. If I show them where it is and then free them, they'll be able to forage for their own food, rabbits and such, and they'll also know where to come for shelter.
They won't follow us?
Not if they're told not to.
You can do that?
He looked at her with some awe.
No,
Naomi said matter-of-factly.
I don't speak dog, nor does Frisky speak human, but she understands it. If I tell Frisky, she'll tell the others. They'll hunt what they need, but they won't range far enough to lose the scent of my bedroll, not with the storm coming. And when it starts, they'd go to shelter. It won't matter if their bellies are hungry or full.
And if we had something that belonged to this boy Dennis, you really believe Frisky could track him?
Aye.
Ben looked at her long and thoughtfully. Dennis had left this farm on Tuesday. It was now Sunday. He didn't believe any scent could last that long. But there was something in the house which would bear Dennis's scent, and perhaps even a fool's errand would be better than only sitting here. It was the pointless sitting more than anything else that grated on him, the hours ahead when things of grave importance might be happening elsewhere while they sat and twiddled their thumbs here.
Under other circumstances, the possibility of being snowbound with a girl as beautiful as Naomi would have delighted him, but not while a kingdom might be won and lost 20 miles to the east, and his best friend might be living or dying with only that confounded butler to help him.
Well? She asked eagerly. What do you think?
I think it's crazy, he said, but worth a try.
She grinned.
Do we have something with his scent strong upon it?
We do, he said, getting up. Bring your dog in, Naomi, and lead her upstairs to the attic. 98.
Although most humans don't know it, scents are like colors to dogs. Faint scents have faint colors, like pastels washed out by time. Clear scents have clear colors. Some dogs have weak noses, and they read scents the way humans with poor eyes see colors, believing this delicate blue may actually be a gray, or that dark brown may actually be a black. Frisky's nose, on the other hand, was like the eyesight of a man with the gaze of a hawk, and the scent in the attic where Dennis had slept was very strong and very clear. It may have helped that Dennis had been some days without a bath. Frisky sniffed the hay, then sniffed the blanket the girl held for her. She scented Arlen upon it, but disregarded the scent. It was weaker and not at all the scent she had found on the hay. Arlen's smell was lemony and tired, and Frisky knew at once that it was the smell of an old man. Dennis's smell was more exciting and vital. To Frisky's nose, it was the electric blue of a summer lightning stroke. She barked to show that she knew this smell and had put it safely away in her library of scents.
All right, good girl, the tall boy said. Can you follow it?
She'll follow it,
the girl said confidently.
Let's go.
It'll be dark in an hour.
That's so,
the girl said, and then grinned. When the girl grinned that way, Frisky thought her heart might just burst with love of her.
But it isn't her eyes that we want, is it?
The tall boy smiled.
I guess not, he said. You know, I must be crazy, but I think we're going to pick up these cards and play them.
Course we are, she said. Come on, Ben. Let's use what little daylight's left. It'll be dark soon enough.
Frisky, her nose full of that bright blue scent, barked eagerly. 99. Peter's supper came promptly at 6 o'clock that Sunday night. The storm clouds hung heavy over Delane, and the temperature had begun to drop, but the winds hadn't yet begun to blow, and not a snowflake had fallen. On the far side of the plaza, shivering in stolen cook boys' whites, Dennis stood anxiously, drawn back into the deepest shadow he could find, staring at the single square of pale yellow light at the top of the needle. Peter's candle. Peter, of course, knew nothing of Dennis's vigil. He was filled with the wonder of the idea that, live or die, this would be the last meal he would ever eat in this damned prison cell. It was just more tough, salty meat, half-rotted potatoes and watery ale, but he would eat it all. For the last 3 weeks, he had eaten little and had spent all the waking time he did not spend working at the tiny loom, exercising, readying his body. Today, however, he had eaten everything brought to him. He would need all his strength tonight.
What will happen to me?
He wondered again, sitting down at the little table and grasping the napkin that lay over his meal.
Where exactly will I go? Who will take me in? Anyone? All men, it said, must trust in the gods, but Peter, you are trusting so much it's ridiculous.
Stop. What'll be is what'll be. Now eat and think no more of... But that was where his restless thoughts broke off, because as he shook the napkin out, he felt a small stab, like the prick of a nettle. Frowning, he looked down and saw that a tiny bead of blood had seeped up on the ball of his right forefinger. Peter's first thought was a flag. In the fairy tales, it was always a needle that bore the poison. Perhaps he had been poisoned now, by flag. That was his first thought, and not such a silly one at that. After all, flag had used poison before. Peter picked the napkin up, saw a tiny folded object with black smudgy marks on it, and flipped the napkin back down at once. His face remained calm and peaceful, giving away none of the wild excitement that had burst up inside him at the sight of the note pinned inside the napkin. He glanced casually toward the door, suddenly afraid he would see one of the lesser warders, or Beeson himself, staring suspiciously in at him, but there was no one.
The prince had been a great object of curiosity when he first came to the needle, stared at as avidly as a rare fish is stared at in a collector's tank. Some of them had even smuggled their lady loves up to look at the murdering monster, and they would have been imprisoned for it themselves if they had been caught. But Peter was a model prisoner, and he had palled quickly. No one was looking at him now. Peter forced himself to eat his entire meal, although he no longer wanted it. He wanted to take not the slightest chance of rousing suspicions, now more than ever. He had no idea who the note might be from, or what it might say, or why it had aroused such a fever in him. But for a note to come now, only hours before he planned to make his try to escape, seemed an omen. But of what? When his meal was finally eaten, he glanced toward the door again, made sure the spy hole was closed, and walked to his bedroom with his napkin still held casually in one hand, almost as if he had forgotten that he held it at all. In the bedroom, he unpinned the note, his hands were trembling so badly he pricked himself again, and unfolded it. It was written closely on both sides in letters which were rusty and a bit childish, but readable enough. His glance went first to the signature, and his eyes widened. The note was signed, "Dennis, your friend and servant forever."
"Dennis,"
Peter muttered, so flabbergasted he was unaware that he had whispered aloud.
"Dennis."
He turned back then, and the letter's opening was enough to shock his heartbeat into a fast drum roll. The salutation was, "My King." 100.
"My King. As you may know, for the last 5 years I have battled in service to your brother, Thomas. In just this last week I have found out that you did not murder your father, Roland the Good. I know who did, and Thomas knows as well. You would know the name of this black killer if I dared to write it, but I do not. I went to Pena. Pena has gone to join the exiles with his butler, Orlorn. He has commanded I come to the castle and write to you this note. Pena says that the exiles may soon become rebels, and this must not be. He thinks you may have some sort of plan, but what he knows not. He commands that I be of service to you, and Mada commanded it too before he died, and my heart commands it, for our family has always served the king, and you are the right king. If you have a plan, I will aid you in any way I can, even if it means my death. As you read this, I am across the plaza, in the shadows looking at the needle where you are pent up. If you have a plan, come, I pray you, and stand at the window. If you have something on which you can write, then throw down a note, and I will try to retrieve it late this night. Wave twice if you will try this idea. Your friend Ben is with the exiles. Pena said he would send him. I know where he, Ben, will be. If you say I should fetch him, Ben, I can in a day, or perhaps two if there is snow. I know that throwing down a note might be risky, but I feel time is short. Pena feels the same way. I will be watching and praying. Dennis, your friend and servant forever."